The Opera House is the people's house. It's the greatest achievement that our society has, and we have cheapened it and degraded it.
A culture of greed. That is what the Royal Commission into the Banks has found is behind the despicable behaviour plaguing some of our biggest financial institutions.
We are coming. It's okay.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Many, many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
The Sydney Opera House horse racing scandal. The potentially criminal conduct of the big four banks unveiled in a royal commission. And the incredible retrieval of 12 schoolboys from a cave in Thailand. Three of 2018's biggest stories. One local, one national, one international. They all had something in common. They struck at the hearts of Australians, whether they made us angry, appalled, or brought us hope. Journalists have the privilege of bearing witness to some of the most significant moments in history. Sometimes a story is so big it can't be told within the confines of a newspaper article. This episode you'll hear from our journalists about the story behind stories that have become books.
The Sydney Opera House, now at last complete.
I will never, ever trust anybody again.
He gave the boys all the food and water that he had on him when they first went into the cave.
From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Tori Maguire. In this special episode of Please Explain, we're going to try something a little different. We're looking back on the year that was in a unique way, through the eyes of the people who were there. You'll hear three great interviews with reporters speaking to their colleagues about what it was like to tell these wild and wonderful yarns from 2018. In June, the world first heard the awful news that 12 Thai boys aged 11 to 17 and their young coach were missing.
A boy's bicycle, pairs of soccer shoes, a backpack. Signs outside a Thailand cave of the 12 boys believed lost inside, along with their soccer coach. Authorities think they've been trapped since Saturday.
Then came the flickering video of the huddle of anxious and hungry boys found by a pair of British divers 9 days later.
How many of you? 13. Brilliant.
But the most difficult part was yet to come. Monsoon rains had raised the water level in the cave system, and the boys were trapped in an air pocket, surrounded by rising muddy water, over 2 kilometres from the cave entrance. James Masola's book, The Great Cave Rescue, recreates the drama, tension and inspiration of the days in July 2018 when the eyes of the world were trained on a remote Thai mountain. James and his fixer, Veena Thupcrier, were interviewed by their boss, foreign editor Michael Bachelard.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, James and Veena. It's a great book. I've read it. You've done a really good job in a very short time. But it occurred to me when I was reading it, there's a lot of tension in this book. But of course, everybody knows the ending. Everyone knows how it turns out. How did you manage to maintain the tension on a story that we're so familiar with?
Michael, I tried to do two things to get and keep readers' interest in writing this book, because as you say, everyone knows how it, you know, what the ultimate ending was. The first was, in a book as opposed to a newspaper article, you know, you've got the kind of big reveal at the end of each chapter, which drags the reader on, hopefully, into the next chapter and keeps them interested. So you change the way that you actually write the story. The second thing we did, and I think that was more important, is that we researched and interviewed and you know, went back to the cave in Thailand and tried to find out new information. And I think we succeeded in at least getting a few big reveals.
Can you tell us, without giving away the ending, what some of those reveals are?
Well, some really basic information about what happened in the cave wasn't actually in the public domain. So, for example, on what day which boys came out in what order. Another thing, another piece of information which I loved personally was how the boys decided in what order they would come out. So that it was left up to them by Richard Harris, by Dr. Pak, the Thai doctor who was in the cave with the boys for those second sort of 9 days or so. And the boys basically had a chat with among themselves with their coach, Coach Ek, and they decided that the boys who lived furthest away from the cave would be the ones who would come out first, because they would have the longest bike rides home. And I love that little detail because it tells you they kind of had no idea what a massive global story this had become.
Well, that's right. I mean, we were all watching, weren't we? The other thing I really liked about the book was the way that you managed to, in certain passages, to convey this sort of idea of claustrophobia. These guys diving in tiny little spaces in darkness and muddy water. When you were writing it, did you kind of feel the wall starting to close in on yourself?
Yeah, look, absolutely, Batch. And to kind of try and convey a sense of reality, a sense of just what it was like in those passages, in those caverns, I relied pretty heavily on the interviews I'd done with the Danish diver Ivan Karadzic, with the Canadian diver Eric Brown, who were, you know, very much involved in the final 3 days of the rescue, with some interviews I'd done with the Australian Federal Police while on the ground for the Age and SMH, and also from talking to a couple of the British experts, just to get a sense of what it was like in there, because they were incredibly cramped passages. You know, you had pinch points that were perhaps 60, perhaps 40 centimetres wide. And, you know, those divers were sort of weaving in and out, pulling themselves through, dragging the boys along, pushing them ahead. I mean, it would have been incredibly hard work to get those boys out.
Veena, you were there during the rescue, as was James, and you were the one who went back afterwards and did a lot of research for this book over a very short time frame. How did you find that process, such a short time frame and such a large amount of information to come across?
Yes, Michael, I think it's quite demanding. First, I heard the deadline from James, and I think, oh, it's very challenging. But it's good that he throw me all the questions and all the facts to check, and I have to get back to the issue, and we find out more facts, and then we dig into it. And I would say, frankly, it's very difficult. After the boy came out, like the government, the official, quite protective of them. So to get into them and to get what James want is quite a job, you know. Sometimes we got to get around, and I have to stand by. You know, we communicate via WhatsApp and then answer the question and go around and get in touch with all the official. And they are so busy. They were so busy after the KF thing. Attend the events and the government function, and quite difficult to get them.
One of the great, I remember during the writing and researching process, Batch, one of the great triumphs was the day we actually worked out which boys came out on what day. And that was Veena who did that through kind of back channels, through a top of back channels, if you like. You know, another great highlight was when we got into contact with a couple of the mums, had a bit of a chat to them, got some information. I mean, that was really hard to get to them, and Veena managed it. It was fantastic.
Because after a month, nobody knows who come out first or not. It's all week. And I myself met the governor, Mr. Narong Sak, who in charge of the operation. And I asked him in person, and he said, oh, it's already there in the press. I said, no. He said, oh, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Why do you think the Thai authorities have been so locked down about this?
I think they don't see it as important facts. Why we do, we did. So, and also, you know, they don't want to give details of why this one come first and all, which is nothing wrong, but they just don't want to say it. Nobody say it, yep. Actually.
Yeah, it was very hard to get to the boys. They were very protective of him. In the early days, they were saying this is, you know, to ensure that they have a normal life. They had psychological care. You know, they went off and became monks for a short, novice monks for a short period of time. The Thai government, I mean, there's been a military regime there for 5 years. There hasn't been a lot of good news out of Thailand for perhaps 15. There's been two coups there. It now seems like they're realising this is actually a really good news story for Thailand and potentially for themselves heading into the election, which is supposed to be February 2019, and they're starting to capitalise this, but on this aspect, perhaps to drag up their own popularity. But in the early days, it was really a lockdown. It was really tough.
Speaking of good news, one of the things that really struck me in the book was the observation, and it came from a number of the divers, that they hadn't really expected to get all the children out alive. In fact, some of them had predicted that, that up to half of them might die, or even all of them might die. And this is not something that, that I had heard before. Was that quite a revelation to you?
Yeah, look, Richard Harris, I think, was the doctor, you know, the Australian doctor in there. He's on the public record as saying he thought that perhaps none of them would survive. And you hear something like that. This is one of the absolute architects, one of the absolute heroes of the rescue, who is in there giving the ketamine shots, giving the sedatives, you know, instrumental in designing the sort of escape route, if you like, for the boys, or the plan, that he was so despondent about the chances. I was pretty shocked as well. But it tells you as well just how risky it was. These divers are experts. They knew how tough this was. And Vina, I'm sure you'd remember the day that Suman Gunan died, that Friday morning when we got to the camp. I mean, yeah, it was incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah. And many pressed as the Navy ship, if the diver couldn't survive, how the kid would do it.
Yeah, that's right. When that happened, we thought they'll never be able to dive them out. But 3 days later, they started.
The other thing that was really, to me, striking about this book was how, while much of the media at the time had been focused on the efforts of the Western divers and the military and so on from Western countries, and rightly so, this book really paints a much broader picture. It paints a picture about the place and the people in that place, about the volunteers, about the guy who came with the pumps because he recognised that the government's pumps were too small. I think you've done that well. You've broadened the story out to from just the Western angle to much more a story about how Thailand responded. Vina, that's obviously partly your doing. How did you go about that?
Actually, it's kind of a big story in Thailand, how they become united and how everyone want to be part of it. Like even a laundry shop, she wash the clothes for the U.S. group for free. And then even the kids come to the site and collect the garbage. And everyone want to be part of it, physically or mentally, whatever one can help. Like on the Facebook, there are people who said, okay, who want a volunteer for translator? I can do it. And on social media, whoever want, you know, to help, they just post it. And everyone want to be part of it and share the same goal. It's one of a very special time. If you can cook, you come to the site. Even the masseur, she came at the site and said, I want to set up a massage for the soldier. And a haircut, free haircut, something like that.
Yep, free underpants. Yeah. All this food.
You know, like this mission, you see the diver at the key to bring the kids out. But the whole operation, everyone has tiny part in it. The whole thing, you know, can operate. Like the bathroom, that the one lady just stayed there. And I asked her, I said, when you going back? She said, no, until the kid come out. And she always there in front of the bathroom and cleaning.
Yeah, I remember those toilets.
That and they're so
shocking.
Muddy.
Yeah, it was awful. Like, we were pretty basic toilets, public toilets in a national park being used by, what, a couple of thousand people each day. They were, yeah, I mean, they were in remarkable condition given what was going on at the time. But, you know, to that broader point, Batch, about Thailand being kind of brought together or unified, I mean, and Vina could talk to this point as well. I mean, this is a country that's really politically divided between North and South. You've got the political elite in Bangkok and the kind of the main opposition party is centred in the North. You know, in the days gone by, the Thaksin supporters, the Yingluck supporters who feel marginalised. And what this did was kind of bring everyone together, all ties together. And then as the story got bigger and bigger, the world kind of got involved. That was one of the really special things about it.
Well, thank you, Vina. Thank you, James. Thank you for coming in, but also thank you for the book. It's called The Great Cave Rescue. It's a good read, and I hope it goes really well for you.
Yeah, pleasure, Batch. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Michael.
Hey, listeners. We wanted to take a brief moment to wish you a happy new year and let you know we really appreciate your support since launching Please Explain. We also wanted to remind you that The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have a stable of great podcasts, and summer is a good time to check them out, whether you're on holiday, down the beach, or back at work like the rest of us. The podcast team have big plans for this year, so stay tuned. Until then, here's a recommendation from our archives. Then back to the episode.
The Homicide Squad has been called in to investigate the death of a woman in Melbourne.
We begin with the mysterious death of Phoebe Handschuck.
The 24-year-old's body was discovered last night
after plunging 12 stories down a rubbish chute.
Post-mortem will be carried out later today.
No one has ever died this way in Australian history.
Phoebe Handschuck was 24. Complex and beautiful. She lived 12 stories above with her boyfriend, Anthony Hample, a son of Melbourne's legal establishment. But on that night, Phoebe died the most horrific death. She had plunged 40 metres, feet first, down a garbage chute. She survived the fall, but the garbage compactor at the bottom virtually severed her right foot. Phoebe bled out in the dark, alone, her jeans around her knees. But how did she get into the chute, and why? The coroner decided that she'd climbed in herself. He recorded death by misadventure. But there were no fingerprints at the top, and no CCTV footage. Her family doubts the coroner's version was even physically possible. Nearly a decade later, the mystery remains. Phoebe's Fall is a six-part investigative podcast from The Age, and it tells the full story of the short life and brutal death of Phoebe Handschuck. Phoebe's story is one of the great unsolved mysteries of Melbourne, and The Age continues to follow her story. To stay abreast of updates, search for Phoebe's Fall wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe.
In October, a public spat between 2GB shock jock Alan Jones and the management of Sydney Opera House splashed its way across Australia's media.
Yes, it's 8 to 9. The Opera House CEO Louise Herron is on the line. Louise, good morning.
Good morning, Alan.
Louise, people reading the Telegraph newspaper today on the front page will be saying, who the hell do you think you are? You don't own the Opera House. We own it. We own the Opera House. You don't have a right to fence it off.
Jones, with considerable vested interests in the racing industry, was livid that Opera House Chief Executive Louise Herron had resisted a bid from a horse racing event to project advertising onto the sales of the venue.
We own the Opera House. Do you get that message? You don't. You manage it. And if you can't give the go-ahead for this to happen, to an event that's providing $100 million to the economy, delivering a tourism boom to Sydney, to send Sydney around the world, if I were Gladys Berejiklian, I'd pick up the phone and sack you today.
What ensued was weeks of national discussion about what was appropriate for the best-loved building in Australia.
Mixing a day out at the races with the night at the opera hasn't been popular in Australia.
Protesters pointed lasers and spotlights at one of Australia's most famous landmarks.
The protesters did make their presence felt. As the barrier draw was beamed onto the sails, lights from more than 1,000 protesters flickered on the projection.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
The building is a house of art, not a house of advertisement.
People are clearly upset with having Sydney defined as a two-bit gambling town.
For advertising, it's disgusting.
Coincidentally, Herald senior writer Helen Pitt was just launching her book, The House, a historical and cultural ode to that strange and beautiful building. With access to diaries, letters and classified records, as well as her own interviews with people involved in the project, Helen reveals an intimate and sometimes tragic backstory of a building that turned Sydney into an international city. Helen was in the perfect position to answer the questions raised by the racing scandal. What space does this iconic building occupy in the hearts of Australians? Welcome, Helen.
Hi, Tori.
So you're a senior writer at the Sydney Morning Herald, and prior to that you were opinion editor, and you have managed to write this incredible book while also doing your day job. I want to get into the process for you and the decision behind it. So what made you look at the Opera House as the subject for you to really sink your teeth into?
Well, it was quite easy because I've spent a lot of my adult life outside of Australia. And I was a decade in America, 3 years in France, and several years in England. And consistently, the Opera House was the only thing anyone ever knew about my hometown. And because I was a journalist that had begun at the Sydney Morning Herald 32 years ago, it's a narrative I was very familiar with. And I just thought that many people outside of Australia weren't that familiar with it. And then I realised when I moved back to Sydney, many people in the Sydney Morning Herald newsroom weren't that familiar with it either, because it is a 61-year-old story. Mm. So what happened was I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco where I was living, and Jornutson's obituary came on the BBC World Service, and I had an instant stab in my heart because I was from Sydney and he gave the world and our city the most recognisable building of the 20th century. And I felt so sad as I was driving across the bridge, and I had this kind of flashback to a time when I was an eight-year-old on the harbour for the opening of the Sydney Opera House, and listening to the story being recounted on the World Service and the fact that the man that dreamt up this building never got to see it complete really struck me as such a powerfully sad narrative. And so I immediately pitched the idea to my former boss at The Bulletin, who is a publisher by the name of Richard Walsh, who now works for Alan Unwin. That was 10 years ago.
Oh.
So that is 2008. So I have been working on this book more or less for 10 years. It was obviously not all that decade that I spent on it, because I moved back to Australia. I took up a very full-time job. But what it was access to the files at the Sydney Morning Herald, because I was always concerned that they might go away, you know, like the photos of our library had sort of disappeared over the years. I was concerned that they may not stay. So I thought I'll use access that I had at the Herald. I also interviewed all the old Sydney Morning Herald reporters in my time off. So I dropped to, you know, part-time work 4 days a week and spent my time away from the office meeting up with, you know, 91-year-olds and 89-year-olds that had covered the Opera House story, or had either built the building, or I did this all kind of in my spare time. So it was pretty exhausting in between trying to find time to, let alone trying to write it, and, you know, just having to solder yourself off from the rest of the world was really, really quite hard. I went twice to Denmark, and that was really crucial to a place called the Utzon Centre, because, you know, sometimes it takes a long time for people, families in particular, to be ready to show things like old letters. And that was really the gold for me. Some of these letters that had never been made public, telegrams between Gough Whitlam and Jornutson that had never seen the light of day, travel diaries, even these old Grace Brothers removalist tags from his home and moving back to Denmark. There were all these really great things I found in the research of the story. So the longer it took, the better in many ways, even though it was hard to convince them at the time, because why that was really kind of zeitgeisty for me was the book was launched not very long before the controversy over the projection of the Everest advertising on the sails of the Opera House.
People are very emotional about it, aren't they?
People were extraordinarily emotional. They really got upset about a horse racing, an ad for a horse race being projected onto the sails of their beloved building, despite the fact that we paid for the building with lottery tickets that and the proceeds of gambling. It is our first crowdsourced building built with the proceeds of gambling. They were very, very upset. But why that was helpful for me is the sales of my book doubled in that week.
Yeah, very good timing.
Not just Alan Jones, but Louise Herron's response to it and a protest. And people were just really, really brought together over their love of the Opera House. So that's why it was kind of a great thing in many ways for me.
You've ended up sort of creating almost a biography of a living, breathing building in a way, because it still changes and it moves and people have different reactions to it. How did the people, the key players, the families of the key players react to the finished product?
Yeah, well, that was interesting because in many ways it was an unauthorised biography, and my publishers were very keen for me to not be too involved with the Opera House from the very beginning because, you know, it didn't want to be a PR machine, you know, just like spitting up things that the Opera House had wanted us to tell, stories that they'd wanted us to tell. But what Louise Herron has said, you know, very, very graciously to me, is that it is like a fishing net of all the best anecdotes of the building and the people that built it. So that is why I didn't work that closely with them from the very beginning. They only kind of came into the end of when I was actually dealing with it. But the families, as I said, I took some time to convince to be involved. And you know, what is so interesting about this story is it still arouses passions, not just from Sydneysiders, but everyone that's ever touched the building. It's in some ways it's a curse, in some ways it's a blessing, but it still arouses extraordinary passion. So the families were, I had to be very careful in how I retold some stories, not just the people that are directly involved, but, you know, there were people, there was a helicopter crash from 1966 and ABC reporters that were covering the building of that. I uncovered those sorts of things. But it wasn't just that, there's just so many tragedies associated with the building, from Eugene Goossens, whose idea it was from the very beginning, and he ended up departing Australia in a huge scandal around pornography in the 1950s before the competition had taken place. And then there was another really interesting story. I've heard so many anecdotes about the Opera House in the 32 years since I began at the Sydney Morning Herald. I put a lot of them to the test, and one of the ones that I thought was an urban myth turned out not to be, which was great. It was the person who actually chose Utzon's design from the 233 entries. His was entry 2, number 18, 218. And his name was Eero Saarinen, and there were four judges, but he was definitely the man that was pushing for Utzon's selection. So he was supposedly the man that pulled them out of the reject, pulled it out of the reject pile and picked it up and said, "Gentlemen, here is your Opera House." And that, in fact, is a true story. The reason I know that now is I tracked down his son, who's a Hollywood producer, not a big fan of his father's, I might add, but he said, "Look, yes, that is true." And the reason I say that is my father left my mother, and I was never a big fan of him, but work was his passion. And he told that story many times to us. That obviously the judges that remained in Australia said, "Oh, no, it wasn't him. You know, it was an unanimous decision." You know, it really required, you know, talking to family members and, because there's not many people around that are still alive that were, you know, first-hand witnesses. And I did have a very strong sense that if I didn't get these stories down, that the people would die. And actually already in the course of my handing in my completed manuscript and the publication, three of my original sources, which included the very long time Sydney Morning Herald state roundsman, 20 years at the Sydney Morning Herald estate roundsman, John O'Hara, died. And he was crucial to my story.
Well, it's a wonderful project, Helen. What's your next book?
Oh, I can't even begin. I can't stand the thought, Tori, of locking myself away for that amount of time. So for now, I'm just getting out, back into the sun, losing the 10 kilos that I put on while riding it over the 10 years.
Thanks so much, Helen.
Thanks, Tori.
When it comes to stories that rocked Australia in 2018, it's hard to go past the revelations unearthed in the Banking Royal Commission. Allegations of serious misconduct from the big banks were finally aired out in the commission, where Australians watched as financially ruined citizens told their stories and CEOs and managers were sacked or quit.
Two of the country's biggest banks have been slammed for failing to submit clear evidence on the first day of hearings in the Financial Services Royal Commission.
Investor groups and politicians called for Ms Brenner to go after the Royal Commission heard that AMP misled the corporate regulator ASIC on 20 occasions. The Commission also heard senior executives altered an independent review of the practices of charging a fee for no service.
Top high-rated issue from audits in this period is a failure to comply with the requirement that the advice is likely to be in the best interests of the client.
Yes, I can see that.
But all this started years before. Adele Ferguson is a Walkley Award-winning investigative reporter for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Her exposés on the banks over many years pushed and pushed for a royal commission. The hubris displayed by the financial sector grew from a seed planted in 1985. And this is where Adele starts her forthcoming book, Banking Bad. Adele was interviewed by Clancy Yates, business reporter in our Sydney newsroom, covering banks for The Herald and The Age.
Adele, we've had an enormous amount of media coverage of the Hayne Royal Commission into banking misconduct this year. What made you want to write a book about it?
Well, as it's one of the most important events that we have had for a long time, and as great as the media coverage has been, I just felt that it needed to be put into context. And to do that, you needed to have a lot of length, and that required a book. And I had a number of publishers who'd contacted me because I'd been writing a lot of the exposés of banks over the last few years. And I felt that if I said no, it would be a big regret. So that's why I said yes.
And we know that your book is titled Banking Bad: How Greed and Broken Governance Conspired to Break Our Trust in Corporate Australia. And we also know it's coming in August next year. How far are you through the task?
Ah, okay. So I am written about 60,000 words. So I've still got 30,000 words to go. So still quite a mileage to get through.
Your stories are generally long-term investigations as opposed to sort of daily news, but writing an entire book on one topic must be a very different sort of experience. Do you tend to procrastinate when you're working on such a big project?
Well, yes, procrastination definitely comes into it. I remember when I first started, I took leave for a few months from work and I immediately got addicted to Making a Murderer, which is a documentary on someone who was convicted wrongly of rape. And then it just goes through two seasons, more than 20 hours. And I was so addicted to it. I was getting up at 5:30 in the morning to watch the next episode rather than start the book.
But you're into it now.
So, yeah, so I'd say that's procrastination.
And look, banking misconduct is obviously a topic that's of huge public interest. There are at least three other journalists, aside from yourself, working on books on the same topic, on the Royal Commission. How do you think yours is likely to be different?
I'm not just writing about the Royal Commission. I'm going back to 1983 when the financial markets were deregulated to look at when the seeds were really sown for this banking misconduct and taking it from there and then looking at the rolling scandals that continued on from 83. Which puts it into a lot of context for how we ended up getting to this Royal Commission. One of the key characters from 83 is Senator John Williams, Wacker Williams, who was actually a victim of financial deregulation with the Commonwealth Bank. He went to his local branch to get a $200,000 loan and came out with a $640,000 loan that was actually a Swiss currency loan, and it blew up to $1.5 million in 3 weeks. And the saga started from there.
Will we also get a sense of the whistleblowers and the role that they played in your exposés, but also in the history of sort of banking misconduct in Australia?
Absolutely, yes. You'll definitely see a lot of the various whistleblowers and some behind-the-scenes things that went on. So I'll also be in the book, you know, some of the dirty tricks that went on and smear campaigns against myself, whistleblowers. Some of them are pretty shocking.
You've covered these banking scandals for several years now. You've had a few investigations into the Commonwealth Bank, and that's just one example. Did the extent of the poor behaviour that was exposed by the Hayne Royal Commission this year come as a surprise to you?
Some of it did come as a surprise. You know, the financial planning didn't. What really did come as a surprise was a couple of things. One was how weak APRA, the prudential regulator, was, how it's really been the see no evil, hear no evil regulator. We didn't really know that. The other thing that really shocked me was the hearings on superannuation, where you saw the embedded conflicts with the trustees and how far they're willing to go to dud over customers.
And some of your stories in the past, they've been based on information from whistleblowers, as well as people like John Williams that you've mentioned. Now, these stories were really critical in getting the ball rolling for a Royal Commission. How do the whistleblowers feel about what's happened? Do they feel vindicated, or is there a sense that we're only now really sort of scratching the surface?
They're feeling it's bittersweet, really. On the one hand, they feel vindicated. They've been battling to get, you know, a royal commission for a long time, but then they're disappointed that it went for 12 months and that a lot of the characters inside these organisations had already left and weren't called up. So they've got off scot-free.
And will you be dealing with the where it goes now sort of question?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so we're looking at, you know, the findings of the Royal Commission and then where that lands, because I think one of the common themes I've found going back a number of years is you can have the best recommendations in the world, it's what happens to them. They generally get watered down and evaporate. So it'll be looking at what we see next.
Okay. And what's your sense there? Do you think that this process has been rigorous enough to really stamp out misconduct in the long term? Or is there a risk that we're in the same place in 5 years' time and the banks go back to their old ways?
I think there's definitely a risk that the banks will go back to their old ways. You know, there needs to be genuine change. And at the moment, we're still seeing lip service, as we saw from the AGMs, where, you know, it took shareholders to actually vote down remuneration packages, you know, record votes, to show that they still don't get it.
And so what sort of changes do we need to see for you to be convinced that we really could sort of stamp out misconduct within the banking industry?
I think we need to have an overhaul of the regulators. They need to be better remunerated. They need to have stronger powers. And we also need to have a lot more criminal convictions. We need to see heads on sticks with some of these people who've done the wrong thing, not just now, but in the past. They need to be looked at. And I think that's the way that will send a strong message that this has got to be cleaned up.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for chatting, Adele. It's been really interesting and can't wait to read the book next year.
Thank you. I'll get back to finishing it off.
Good luck with that.
Thanks, Clancy.
Thanks to all those involved in this episode. James Masola, Vina Thupcryer, Michael Bachelard, Helen Pitt, Adele Ferguson and Clancy Yates. Next week, we're back to the usual format to kick off 2019. It's sure to be a big year in national affairs, not least of which a federal election. Summer's a great time to catch up on podcasts, driving down to the beach or time off overseas. If you know someone who would love Please Explain, help them find the pod. We're also keen to know what you'd like to hear more of in the new year. You can email the team via the podcast link on the Sydney Morning Herald and Age websites. Right now, we're running a summer sale on subscriptions to the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age. Signing up now means you'll save 50% for 6 months on your weekend paper deliveries, plus unlimited digital access. Follow the link in our show bio to get a subscription today. This episode was produced and edited by Rachel Dexter. Technical assistance from Cormac Lally, David McMillan and Declan Bowery. Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.